Friday evening. And back tonight with us is Mr. Ralph Ring. We had a wonderful conversation. I don't know how many weeks ago it's been now, but you can find it in the archives. And Ralph is a man of extraordinary depth and experience. He was involved with Otis Carr, C-A-R-R. He is, without question, one of the few people to work with someone who knew and was a protege of Nikola Tesla. This is an extraordinary in and of itself. Let's just jump right in. Ralph, thank you for being here. How have you been?
I've been fine. Thank you for asking, Jeff. Good. Marcia's here with me, of course.
Hi, Marcia.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Good to hear your voice. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
Now, Otis T. Carr, C-A-R-R, protege of Nikola Tesla. During the years you worked with Otis Carr, first of all, how many years did you work with him approximately?
Well, on and off, I guess about 2 years.
Uh-huh. Did he ever sit you down, or, you know, a couple or three of you, and talk to you about the great man, Tesla?
Oh, very definitely.
Can you tell us, I'd love to hear an anecdote or two that he might have shared with you, because to be, and I'm sure you've thought about this probably half a lifetime or more, to be in the presence of a mind like Nikola Tesla's, a mind of the universe, a mind of all ages, a genius, beyond a genius, must have been, I don't even know how to describe it. But tell us what Otis T. Carr had to say.
Well, thank you for setting the stage there. In what I'm about to say, I have to quote Khalil Gibran in the book called The Prophet.
Sure.
In which he said, half of what I say to you is meaningless, but necessary so that the other half may reach you. That's a quote from Khalil Gibran.
That's a very interesting statement. I remember reading that once long ago.
And the reason I brought that up, because in many things that I would like to share with everybody, is the feelings, and all I can do is use metaphors to the max to give you some of the things that are truly beyond words, and the experiences that I had with Carr and his relationship with Tesla. It we're not confined to the narrow space of Earth or our bodies or
or the semantics of words and phrases and all of that. I understand.
Right.
This is what we're going to do is try to deal with something on a verbal level that is just not, it doesn't fit, but it's the best thing we have, so we'll give it a go.
Yeah, and if you read between the lines what I'm saying, I think you'll pick up the feelings that I'm trying to portray using metaphors.
Sure, sure.
Okay, well, I don't know where we left off, Jeff. I think it was the cliffhanger because people were hearing the background of myself
yes.
How I got acquainted with Carr. But we were about to get into the mechanics of building spaceship.
Right. That was the point at which we stopped, paused, and this is something that is, again, I hope all of you can go back and listen to the first part of our conversation, something that is just incredible and all true, in fact, beyond true. Go ahead, please.
Okay, well, I'll refresh just a short portion of it. Carr showed up by the invitation of the group called Understanding, and that was created by Dr. Daniel Fry in the early 50s, I believe. 50. It was before Giant Rock. Yes, it was around 56 or 57 he created it.
Now, for our listeners, if I might, Ralph, Giant Rock, please look that up, do a search for it. It was a giant rock. I've seen it, driven past it, and it actually fell in almost in half. It cracked. But it was a meeting place for abductees, experiencers, all sorts of people, and tremendously deeply involved with the UFO field in the 1950s. And people used to fly in there from all over the place in their small planes to participate in these conferences that actually took place under the rock in many cases, in a big room.
And Howard Hughes, of course, Van Tassel, the proprietor there, I guess you'd call him that,
sure.
Was the test pilot for Howard Hughes. So Howard Hughes used to come in once a month at least and visit.
He did. This is fascinating. So Howard flew himself out to Giant Rock, would land and visit with Van Tassel.
Yes.
Well, this suggests then, doesn't it, Ralph, that Howard Hughes was probably very well up to speed on the whole UFO ET thing.
No doubt in my mind at all.
Mm-hmm.
He was limited only by the circumstances surrounding him and his position of being locked up and put away for good by saying things out of context and so forth.
This man was another. Now, I wouldn't call him a he certainly wasn't a Tesla equal, but he was a man, in a way, out of time as well, was he not?
Oh, yes. From my talks with Van Tassel, when George explained Howard Hughes, he put him in a picture that was far above and beyond the ordinary person, not the one that he seemed to be at all.
Right. Now, just for our listeners, look up Howard Hughes and see what happened to Howard. The CIA got him, basically, and drugged him, kept him prisoner, took over the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which was a front for all kinds of activities. And I was working in Las Vegas as the news director at the ABC TV station, an anchorman, when Howard Hughes lived there and when Howard Hughes died. He died in, what the hell was it, Costa Rica? I can't remember now, but he died out of the country. Panama somewhere. And then there was, you remember, of course you remember the Howard Hughes Mormon Will. Remember that? The Howard Hughes Mormon Will. The film they made about it was called Melvin and Howard. It was about Melvin Dumar, the gas station attendant, who found this older man who had been riding a motorcycle out in the desert, who crashed and had broken his arm. I think he broke his arm. Anyway, drove him back to Las Vegas. The man happened to be Howard Hughes. And Hughes had escaped from the Desert Inn where he was being kept a virtual prisoner and had gotten on a motorcycle and took off out in the desert. Melvin and Howard, it's a great movie, and it's essentially the truth. Now,
Melvin and Howard?
Melvin and Howard, that's the name of the movie. Starring Jason Robards as Howard Hughes and Paul LaMatte as Melvin Dumar. These real people, real story. And Howard wrote a will. He knew he was in trouble. He wrote a will. He wrote it in longhand on yellow, 8.5 by 14 legal notepad.
Oh my gosh.
After he died, I don't know who put the will into the county, Clark County clerks. I don't mean to get into this, but it's interesting and it might fit in. But the will was submitted and filed for probate with the Clark County clerk in Clark County, in what Las Vegas is. Now, when this was made known, ABC sent out a crew. I went over there, and I ended up producing the lead spot on the ABC Evening News about the Howard Hughes. They called it the Mormon Will, because in that will, he left, I think there were a dozen primary beneficiaries that he designated have his estate. And Melvin Dumar was given, I think, 1/12 of it, because Melvin was honored by Howard as being a real, honest-to-God, nice human being. And he put him in the will. Anyway, I saw this thing. I could have reached out and touched it. And it was certified by handwriting analysts as being 100% legitimate. It was Howard Hughes' writing. But then the CIA got involved and fired counteractions against it through third parties, I think through the Summa Corporation, which was Hughes Corporation, I can't remember exactly, but they filed an action challenging the will, and they produced their own handwriting experts that said, no, this wasn't Howard Hughes writing at all. And that's how they got rid of the Howard Hughes, the real Howard Hughes will. Anyway.
Yeah, well, oh boy. Yeah, Howard Hughes was one of those visionaries that was trying to change things for people, too. And unfortunately, he was totally misunderstood in his in everything that he was doing. So he kind of had to stay under the radar for most of the time, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, please go ahead. So Hughes used to go to Giant Rock, you were saying, and that's fascinating because Van Tassel used to be a test pilot for him.
Yes, yes. And see, to continue our saga, our story, the understanding group, Carr was running into trouble in Norman, Oklahoma, he was demonstrating some some feats of circular foil craft, and he ran into a little bit of trouble. The seams at that time around the periphery of the craft were just seamed together. They weren't locked over. They weren't locked into each other. So
kind of just pressed together or folded over.
Yeah, they were pressed together, and they should have been folded over.
Right.
And this was a real young spaceship because they were using mercury. We found out later, just don't even touch mercury. But the seams came apart, and he got splattered with mercury, and they rushed him and put him in the hospital for a while. But during that time, the press and the people and the whatever it is, the force that doesn't want things like this to happen, were giving misinformation out and trying to say that he was
a quack.
A quack, yeah. Well, that was, thank you. that's in a word, covers it.
So he was demonstrating this craft at Norman, Oklahoma, which is where the university is there. Mm-hmm. And it failed due to physical issues that had nothing to do with its legitimacy and value as a piece of machinery that worked. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So the understanding group called him, or they had sent a runner out to him, I'm not sure, but he said, well, I understand you're having some difficulties here. And we're from California, and we have some places that are still private or isolated enough to be private. And we'd like you to come out and join us with Ralph Ring, because he's talking the same kind of language. And so in a nutshell, they packed up, and the entourage was about eight. I think there was seven or eight. People had engineers, the PR people, they had Wayne and Arthur Aho with them. And anyhow, they all came out. And
did they come to Costa Mesa, Ralph? Was this still?
Yes, that's right. Costa Mesa was where the understanding group was located. And they had already arranged one of the people that was in the meeting had a huge place on Lake Arrowhead, just a huge, big, oversized cabin, and said, why don't you guys go up there, settle in, enjoy whatever you like, and we'll provide you with everything you need, and just rest, because this is in, and they use the term divine hands, and everything is already going to be taken care of for you.
Wow! So, now this group, the understanding group, that was the group in Costa Mesa that you worked with, or were they tangentially involved?
No, they. I worked for Advanced Kinetics in Costa Mesa.
Yeah, right.
And then while I was reluctantly leaving my job, my friend introduced me to the understanding group and said, come on by and talk.
Uh-huh.
So that's where the understanding group came in. And so they put us up.
By the way, if we might, Ralph, let me pause. Ralph was working for Advanced Kinetics. Was that the name of it?
Yes.
Okay, and what Ralph did was basically resolved issues in a matter of minutes or an hour or two that shouldn't be resolved. We're talking about issues of engineering, advanced engineering, physics, propulsion, that kind of thing. And the company told Ralph that they didn't really want solutions, and he was being let go. They obviously they were trying to continue the process of attempting to make breakthroughs when Ralph came in and actually caused them to be obvious to people. He was penalized. All right, is that fair?
Thanks. You covered it. In a metaphoric way, the same scenario is still in existence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's called built-in obsolescence, or don't make it too good because you're not going to make any money. And always keep them looking, keep them searching.
Mm-hmm. So the money is in the hunt, not the discovery of the solution. They don't want this.
Right.
It's like the war on cancer. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. We know some doctors that are rendering cannabis to the felines and the dogs and the cats.
Uh huh.
With cancers, and they go right in to the cancer cell, eat them up, and the cancer disappears.
If you don't believe that, look up, just do a search for cannabis and cancer, and it's all there for you.
Good, good. Write that down, honey. So anyway, where was I?
They were sent up to Lake Arrowhead.
Yes, and... I got really acquainted with Carr. It was kind of the whole thing was kind of very mystical to me. I mean, because we were in a state of mind that is and no nonsense, if you want to put that hanger on it, just to the point of knowing, not a lot of explanation.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me, I don't know what's happening to me tonight.
Get that young man a cup of hot tea, and that'll,
okay.
That'll calm him right down. Don't worry about it.
Thank you. So, Carr was just matter of fact being. He didn't want to do a lot of explaining. He says, "I'm giving you enough information that you can see the picture if you wish of what I'm talking about."
Really? Who did he make that statement to, Ralph?
To me. He's always in touch with his group, his entourage.
Yeah. But he recognized, okay, when you were introduced to him, he must have sensed and recognized right away, or maybe he heard about you that you were unusual.
I was unheard of in those days. No, I didn't amount to anything. I don't think anybody knew anything.
But he shared with you. He talked with you readily. Yes. So you had his confidence. That's what I'm trying to say, I think.
Yes, indeed. And it was like I was talking to a very spiritual being, not a human being at all. I mean,
really?
One that was very benevolent in his manners. Very polite, very very precise. Every word was almost delicious. I mean, they just rolled into a melody when he was talking.
What an interesting description. Wow.
So we hit it off pretty darn good, and him and I would sit up all night long, and it was a strange thing. In getting into that range of conversation, mm-hmm. The body seems to go into a semi-rest period because we never got sleepy, never got tired, and that went on for sometimes a couple of days. I mean, I'd grab a nap once in a while, but we were almost living on the energy of the experience.
That's fascinating. What were some of the things that you discussed? It sounds like it was a pretty wide-ranging.
Well, we first discussed the opportunity on this
planet to bring into balance, rebalance at one time and it slipped away,
right.
The difference between living in a duality system of right and wrong, good and bad, up and down, to a state of just knowing and communicating less in words and more in gestures and feelings, body language, different ways of communicating.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, in order to do this, you have to realize that the game is waking people up because they've all allowed themselves to go back to sleep because they weren't using them. And they don't, it's just like exercise. If you don't use them after a while, they go to sleep. And what we have to do in order to get them to realize there is a balance that can be found and maintained, but they have forgotten it. And all you have to do is remind them. You don't have to teach them. You don't have to really tell them. You can metaphorically explain to them that there's more life. There's more to life than they've been told.
Was he talking, Ralph, about reaching out to humanity en masse, or was he talking about certain individuals who might be ready for this kind of an advance?
Well, he kind of maybe he was testing me or whatever. I don't know. He kind of put me on point because he was saying, let's see if I can remember his words. Everybody is ready. It's you that have to realize that and go use that as your intention and your motivation to engage in conversations with seeds in it, as he put it. And the seeds may not be recognized or seen then, or in some cases for a long time. But those seeds are like stem cells. They go into the system and look around for anything that's imbalanced in the human vessel and affect a wake-up call. Change,
huh.
Come on, get back to work. Get back to work.
Very good. All right, hold on a second, Ralph. I got to pause for just a couple minutes. We'll come right back with Ralph Ring. This is... I've got more questions about Mr. Kara. This is a very interesting man, obviously. Back in a minute. Okay, and we're back with Ralph Ring, who's talking about sitting up all night, sometimes for days on end, talking with Otis T. Carr, whose biography, interestingly, has his birthday and his location on his passing, Pittsburgh, 1982, I think, but there's no location of his birth listed. Interesting. Okay, Ralph, go ahead and tell us more. Oh, by the way, in the 1950s, when Otis T. Carr and his OTC company were being talked about, Fate magazine, that old standard, spent a lot of time giving Otis Carr publicity. Not all of it was complimentary, though. He was very controversial. He was apparently on Long John Nebel's radio program. TV talk show is what it was.
Jeff, that's on our website if they care to download it or look into it.
Nice. Very good. And do click on Ralph's name. Go to his website. It's loaded with interesting material. All right. Go ahead, please.
Okay. Well, I just want to remind the audience, the people listening, that I'm metaphorically trying to create what happened to me. I can't possibly remember. I don't even remember now. I can't even picture car's facial expressions right now. It's been 50 so years since it. So I have to use metaphors, because once you've experienced something, it lasts forever.
Right.
It's not going in one ear and out the other. And I hung on every word he said, because he was talking about, like, nobody I've ever talked with before. It's just different. But I was on the same pattern, the same level with him, and I was talking that way too. So it, and there was no difference. I mean, he wasn't, there's no such thing as age or different. We were both talking from the same, you might say, soul.
Mm-hmm.
We're just telling it like it was. So, and he told me, I can tell you a couple of things that he said, like, there's more energy in one drop of water than an entire power station is presently able to produce. That's one drop of water.
Mm-hmm.
And that was from, he studied Schomburg and Walter Russell and, oh my gosh, Reich, a lot of different people. So a lot of this is coming, filtering down from the ones that said great things.
Now, you said Schomburg. Was he also ever acquainted with any of the German scientists, like Victor Schauberger, any of the others?
He talked about Schomburger a lot, but I don't remember saying he met with him or talked with him.
These were geniuses. These men, these so-called rocket scientists, they were into all kinds of, as you know, advanced, ultra advanced technologies that we've not even heard about. But Otis Carr, what was he? What was Otis Carr? Who was Otis Carr? How did he get to the knowledge and reality base, the wisdom base, as an adult male? What was it about his life? Were you able to glean anything from talking to him about what made him what he was?
In his earlier life, he was, much, from what I gathered in talking with him, he was much like the rest of us. You know, he went through his trials and tribulations and things. And but he had a keen interest in I forgot what he called it. He had a word for it, but it was the unusual, the paranormal, or the far out stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So as a kid, he'd go to a circus, and then just the circus wasn't satisfying. He'd go, you know, talk to the donkeys or talk to the actors, or he was a very curious being, and he was soaking up information everywhere growing up. And then when he met Tesla, Tesla liked him because he was a seeker of truth. And Tesla said, on that basis, I want you to work with me. I'll teach you everything I can. They're shutting me down. I'm finished. In so many words, I'm, again, using metaphors. I have no way of knowing the exact wording or anything.
Sure.
I want you to take whatever I can give you and move it forward, because the civilization is swimming backwards. And it doesn't know it. It doesn't realize that it has to be turned around.
He could see it then. It's only accelerated ever since, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And we've been going in the wrong direction for quite some time. And in fact, we've reached the end of the swimming pool. So we have to now. We have an option of turning around or staying put. And to stay put and repeat the things we've been doing for years, like wars and killings and fighting, is a choice that if they want to stay in that state of mind, which is creature comforts and all the things that go with it, the gold watches and the retirement and everything,
sure.
Or they can simply give it all up and turn it over to the universe and say, you win, what do I do next? And if they do that, and that's as simple as that, if you do that, the universe says, oh, finally, here, I'm going to give you everything. And from that point on, you start accepting these blessings, they're gifts that come to you. Like Marcia and I have been living on Social Security for quite some time, but we haven't once been in need or want of anything. Everything's went into place.
Mm-hmm.
Very delay. In fact, we have declined offers of money at sometimes because we get more from just the giving effect of who and what we are and what we do, and something comes back. Something Marcia wanted. She wanted a refrigerator one day, and out the next day we had it. And it's just amazing.
Well, it's somehow you've both been able to dial in the path, and once you find that path, there's really no resistance anymore.
No resistance whatsoever. And we have a saying, all is well in our little kingdom here, because
nice.
we live in paradise up in the hills, in Paradise, California, and it's mm-hmm. beautiful. We've got squirrels and deer in our front yard, and, you know, we just kind of hang out in our little kingdom here.
In your paradise, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Marcia wants to say something. I've been trying to get her on, Jeff, if you could give her a minute.
Sure, Marcia, of course, please.
Oh, I just wanted to say, Ralph found this little place that we're in. It's on Eden Rock Drive in Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a beautiful fern garden in the front of it where the deer and the squirrels come and have a little bird seed now and then, almost every day. It's a beautiful place to be, and it's a great thing. We have to be careful what we want or what we think that would be nice, because it comes. And so we have to really be careful. Yes.
You know, you hear, Marcia, people talk about, well, all you have to do is ask for it, but it doesn't work for 99% of the people or more. Very few people are able to do it, and somehow you two have found that frequency of life that it will work.
Well, it seems like, and I'm just saying, it seems like with our intention, mm-hmm. like with the refrigerator that Ralph just spoke about, I intended or asked for a refrigerator because we get food on a regular basis mm-hmm. from a co-op called Gleaners, and we pay for that. We go every Friday morning and we get food, and with the two of us we get way more than we can use. So I
we
needed
kids to feed.
Yeah, we had a family of five to start off with, and then we have we have different people that we give it to here in the town, and then what's ever left over is actually transported on a weekly basis up to a small town called Herlong, and that's Herlong, California. It's a very small prison town where the children are very abandoned and underfed and that kind of thing. So we feel really good about it. Sometimes it's tiring going and getting it.
To keep it.
Yeah, and so I just said, well, if I had a refrigerator, the bread and the things that need to be refrigerated wouldn't go bad while we were waiting to give our things away, you mm-hmm. know, within that weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And that I feel like the intention, if there's a very a positive reason, that's when the things come.
It has to happen.
Yeah.
It has to happen.
Hmm. And I remember many years ago, Jeff, teaching this, but not actually living it. It was all. It was like now we're walking our talk finally, and mm-hmm. it's like mm-hmm. it's just like letting it happen. We don't do anything. We listen for that inner guidance or that inner feeling that this is what we need to do. We're really just being.
Yeah.
Very nice. Nicely said. I understand.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks, Marcia. Okay.
Thank you, Marcia.
Well, anyway, you know, and, you know, there is different things that I think your audience would be interested in about. I think I mentioned last time we talked about the bumblebee.
Go ahead. Let's tell it again.
Okay, when I was in high school, Santa Cruz, California, I was on the second floor, and I was listening to the teacher explain to the students, bumblebees can't fly. Aerodynamically, they're not equipped to fly, so don't you believe it. And at that moment, I looked out the window, and there was a big, beautiful bumblebee staring me right in the face. And I made a decision intuitively then. I said, you know, I'm going to quit academia. This is the third time that I've been led astray. I'm going back to nature. So I quit academia at that point and went back to, you know, just learning things from nature herself, because it is a different world. But the bumblebee, then I learned from Arthur Aho, who wrote a book, incidentally, called Tomorrow's Energy Need Not Be Fuel. And I just instructed our webmaster to put that on our website, so it's free to download for people. It's a very interesting book.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things it explains is how the bumblebee levitates. It doesn't really fly.
Now, this is interesting. I'm all ears. This is fascinating. So the wings by themselves cannot move enough mass, air mass, to actually cause that bee to fly like a bird would fly.
No, the bee's too heavy. Gravity's pulling the bee down.
I've looked at them. They have small wings. I know what you're saying.
And so the science that said it couldn't fly didn't go far enough to realize, well, what is it doing? And people like Arthur Aho, who is a metaphysical scientist or an esoteric scientist, I remember him showing me a Hendershot device that was a working model of somebody called Hendershot that had this thing working and working and working. I observed it for 2 days and it never stopped, and there's nothing plugged in anywhere. So anyway, but he wrote this book and said that the bumblebee, when he starts beating his wings, starts to, you know, graduate through the vibratory rates, because everything's in vibrations or frequencies. And as he beats his wings, he gets up to his, so this is another metaphor, because I don't know exactly how, well, I know how it works, but I don't know how to explain it any better than metaphorically.
Sure.
The beat of the wings starts to get up and comes to what's known in science as a Schumann resonance frequency. That's
great. 7.89 hertz.
Yes. Thank you, Jeff. That's exactly it. And once that's the beat of the heart, too, by the way. It's the beat of our pulse.
Interesting.
And so that once anything reaches that, and that includes the human beings, only it's a different way of approaching it and a different way of, you have to realize that it doesn't come in academic or linear learning. You have to realize what's happening, and understanding it is the process. But it's quite simple. Once you reach the resonant frequency of anything, you've changed it. And that you take in some of the rock concerts, glasses have been broken on the tables, because the resonant frequency reaches high C or whatever, cracks the glass and shatters the glass. So, and those wavelengths go out now. So once the bumblebee reaches the resonant frequency of his surroundings, he frees himself from what's known and called the gravitational pull or push of
so it's an anti-grav.
Yeah.
How interesting.
Yeah. And then a magnetic bubble. I mean, it's a field. We all have a bubble around us. It's a magnetic field. If you hold your fingers out to a dark or a white background, like two of your, what is that called, the index finger?
Yes.
two of your index finger close together, you can see the magnetic field around your body. And that magnetic field is a shield which holds the manicular structure together. It's all, mm-hmm. all held in by a magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the bumblebee went. And then there was things that Carr was telling me, like fish don't swim. And then that's another, you know, he couldn't talk to the general public because people thought he was totally nuts. But he says, fish don't swim, they swum. S-W-U-M. And birds don't fly, they are flown. F-L-O-W-N. And in probing into that a little bit, he said, when fish, trout, or salmon are in the water and they're seemingly motionless, what right. they are in is a magnetic field, a counter-rotating vortices from the water, with one coming up to the sky and another beam coming down from the sky.
Hmm.
And it's all electromagnetic waves. And the fish gets into those wavelengths, and he can sit there all day long until he wants to move, and then he never does swim. The forces, once he reaches the what we would refer to as a zero point,
uh-huh.
right in the center of a vortex,
uh-huh.
then he excels at incredible speeds, and he can jump, a salmon can jump like 20 feet in the air.
Right.
Believe it or not.
And they don't do that by flicking their tails, right?
No, no. It's all by, they're flown by magnetic resonance. And that's where the system that Carr was explaining, we have to turn around. People think you have to do something. You have to uh-huh. put all this stuff together to make it work. No, you do nothing. But be thankful that nature's there to teach you. And when you back off and listen to nature, then you don't have to do a thing but see it and be it, become it. And that's an experience that you have, and not a book learning where you remember one day and forget the next. And
oh, we 50% memory loss from rote learning overnight, 95% within 5 days or something like that. You can't. That's not how you learn. You can't learn that. That's
not
learning. Nothing to do with wisdom, learning, or knowledge. Nothing.
Right. So anyway, it things like that. I mean,
this is. Excuse me, but Otis Carr and you were talking about these things.
Yes.
And this did these come from? Was Tesla his great awakening? Or did Carr already, was he already odd to begin with? I mean odd in the best possible sense, all right?
Yes, he was odd, and at a young man, he joined the Rosicrucian movement. So that encouraged him to get into a wavelength of learning about alchemy and learning about the mechanics of nature and so forth. So he, through his Rosicrucian background, I'm supposing, because I don't know all, I didn't know everything about him, but he was able to realize that we're living in basically, we're dreaming, right? This is a dream world that we're in, and reality is what we're trying to get back to. And that when you realize that, then it's quite simple to know why you have adversaries and why these seemingly quote unquote bad things seem to happen. Well, until you realize there's no bad things happening, that you are creating an image that is within yourself to balance, and that seems bad at the moment. Like mom telling you to get away from the stove before you burn your hand,
mm-hmm.
and smacking you. Oh, that's bad. But no, it isn't when you look back in retrospect. Thanks, mom. My hand's still here.
Right, right. Yeah.
So,
did Otis tell you, did you call him Otis after a while, or was it always Mr. Carr? How did you address him?
No, I Oh, wow, that's an interesting one. I did call him Otis, yes, a lot. But
you know, when you become close to somebody, you don't even use their names anymore.
Yeah.
You just talk to them.
Yeah.
And I've always found that using someone's name in a conversation, even if you know them well, it tends to instantly put barriers up. If you just talk to them, things mm-hmm. flow.
Yeah, because the barrier is a limitation that we put on ourselves, thinking that that is a reality, or the only reality, I should say, which is ego-generated, instead of being free enough to, well, you don't know who I am. I'm everywhere, and I'm doing everything without a label.
So. All right, and we have just a minute left. And we'll come back for our next hour. Did Otis Carr, I don't know what point in Tesla's life Carr came into it. Do you remember the year approximately? Was it in the 30s? Was it, he died in 43, I think, 42,
yeah.
43. Was it before that in the 30s, or was it when he was living in the New Yorker Hotel? You remember?
Well, Carr was supplementing whatever he was doing, going to school or something, by working as a clerk in the hotel. I remember he told me that Carr would call down and say, go get me some more peanuts, or because Carr would feed the pigeons. He'd go to the center.
Oh, Tesla would call down and said, bring me some more peanuts. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he'd go to Central Park and feed the pigeons there, and then he had his own private pigeons that he fed, and Carr, in Inglorious Repayment, would listen to Tesla tell him things that he'd never dreamed of, and so much so that Carr said, "You've got an open mind, and as long as it's open, I'll try to fill it for you." And he just came off telling him.
Tesla told Carr that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
I told Carr that.
Yeah, fascinating. What a compliment! I'll try and fill it for you. Wow.
Yeah.
All right, stand by, Ralph. We have to pause here, and
okay.
We'll be back with Ralph and Marcia in a few minutes. So hold on, and we will continue.